This podcast is powered by The Plug.
Who's gonna get it out? It ain't even mine to hold, man. Tech ready. Tech that.
All we got is our word. Hello, this is Marisol Solar Therilocker, psychotherapist and consultant. And this is the Resilience and Resistance Podcast, a podcast about successful Black, Indigenous women of color who have overcome trauma and become resilient.
Hi, Jamie. Thank you for being a guest on this podcast.
I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe how you identify, things that would be important for us to know, what you do professionally.
Sure. I am Jamie Torres. I identify she, her, hers, and I am a Chicana Latina, born and raised in West Denver, and I am currently the city councilwoman for Council District 3.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you're here. We tried to make this happen like a long time ago, and then it was my fault.
No.
And then I blamed you.
Initially. But I think we can pretty much blame everything on the pandemic now.
I'll blame it on that.
Official.
It's because of COVID.
It's because of COVID. And everything.
Yeah. I'm Marisol Solar Therilocker. As a trauma expert who's worked in the field for almost 20 years, I'm transitioning from clinical practice to offering workshops, training, and coaching to mid-sized companies, organizations, and nonprofits. I partner with companies and organizations who are interested in building the resilience of their staff and empowering them regarding their mental health and well-being. If this is you, reach out to me so we can start a conversation about how I can help. If you know someone who might be interested, feel free to pass along this information. You can find more at my website, and the link can be found in the show notes. Again, as always, thank you so much for listening. So I think, obviously, we've had a lot of different conversations about our lives, about growing up, about, you know, our professional lives, about our personal lives. And, you know, I think what is always striking to me about your story is just how much it's driven you in terms of your professional life. And I think both, you know, your professional life and then from what I understand, your educational life. So I would love for you just to tell us more about, you know, your family, how you grew up, and those things that feel important in terms of your story.
Sure. We're actually not far from where my grandma was born, I think, near 30th and Larimer-ish. And they ended up moving frequently, but she ended up in the Auraria neighborhood when it was a neighborhood and went to Catholic school and services at St. Cajetan's. And as a teenager, met my grandpa who lived in Sun Valley. And got married. She was young. I was just telling somebody today, I think she was 16. And so she had to have a signature and permission. I mean, I just can't even imagine being 16 and being married. And she had been pulled out of school to take care of 9 brothers and multiple sisters. Her mom got injured. And so she saw marriage almost as an escape toward her own life, and then soon had kids of her own. They ended up buying a house in Villa Park in West Denver, where I was raised. We lived next door to her in a little apartment, a basement apartment. And there are things that I remember having these visceral memories that are either ignited by something I smell or something that I see that just totally take me back to a period of time. And they just were. I think a lot of my growing up was exactly with families who were in similar boats as my own. I went to Catholic school up the street in the neighborhood, and eventually to Eagleton Elementary, Denver Public Schools. I think the big transformation education-wise for me was my mom applying me for scholarship at Grayland Country Day School. And I didn't get in the first time we applied. She applied again the next year, and then I got in. So I was fifth grade, and they picked you up in a bus and picked up all the little West Side kids and carted us off to Grayland Country Day School. And my first exposure to wealth.
Yeah.
And my mom was always the youngest parent anywhere. And she was also a single mom. So, all of that was just a unique experience, but shared as well with some of the other kids that were either bused from this area, East Denver, or West Denver. My sister would end up coming, when she was of age to go to school there. So, pretty interesting. I think it gave me that early exposure to the culture shock that I saw a lot of folks experience when I got to college. But yeah, that was kind of the education side.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, that's so interesting. That early exposure probably helped you adapt more to college, being able to make that transition.
Yeah, it was no different than kind of the other experiences in education that I had. And but I also felt like, as I don't know if it was because I was the oldest, and I don't know that those things always play out, that older kids always act, you know, the same. But I think as a result of having to be much more responsible than my age demanded was one of those things that I think also prepared me for kind of whatever that next challenge was going to be. And, you know, my husband and I we've been seeing a couples counselor for, it's been about a year and a half now.
Yeah.
And thank goodness, and it's going great. And we probably will never stop, because it just allows us to explore something that we'll either easily overlook or disregard that balloons into something else later. So the way that I operate is so independent that it became just a tremendous barrier for our communication. And I compartmentalize things really easily. So I don't seem hurt, or I don't seem affected by something that somebody says or does. I can be distant from it. And which is fine, I think, in work and politics. I think there's an element of that that also keeps us safe and sane.
Yeah.
But in a relationship, that was starting to become our downfall, because he's the opposite. Very much wants to know your reaction and emote, and he's a pursuer and I'm a retreater. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely been such a blessing. And but that's one of the things that I've had to explore there. Is why do I react in that way? And it definitely takes me back to things that I probably purposely tried to forget, whether my mom, you know, and when I talk about kind of these aspects of my mom, it's tougher for me because she is such a hero in my life.
Yeah.
But there's, you can't live without those contradictions.
Yeah.
It's what make people human and what makes our parents so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom, pregnant and a baby at, pregnant 17, baby at 18, still finishing high school, and abandoned by the dad and the other family completely. And puts everything, puts her whole kind of, all of her energy into her daughters. And there's that, and then there are other ways that she was just so heroic to me.
Yeah.
But she had her Achilles heel that also took my grandpa's life, but alcoholism.
Yeah.
And I think we normalized it because other parents were also at the bar all night throughout the week, right? And we'd know numbers like they were our own numbers, you know, asking, when are you coming home? Like, I just remember these things. And so thrust into just making sure my sister was in bed and homework was done and whatever that looked like periodically. But it was so normalized, I think, for us and still is in some cases. But yeah, that there were those pieces that this guy has kind of uncovered both for me and for Jaime, which has been really illuminating for him, I think, too, to find out why we are the way that we are.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I think that, you know, I also tend toward the over-responsible, self-reliant type. Like, you know, I think you perfectly described as so rooted in our childhoods, right? This idea of we just have to do what we need to do in order to keep moving forward, especially as an oldest child.
Yeah.
And how our parents, like, we have this perspective around the complexity of why they did what they did in the moment, and why they had to make choices or, you know, whatever their own traumas were. But it definitely informs how we're able to be in relationship as adults and things that we don't realize, right? That dependence can be very complicated, right? Even healthy dependence and our ability to ask for help, our ability not to withdraw and want to go internal, is so rooted in the ways that we grow up.
And explain ourselves to someone else,
yeah.
You know? There was an element of vulnerability that I remember telling myself when I first met my husband, which was 13, 14 years ago now almost. And that I was going to kind of put my foot forward in a relationship for maybe the first time, and going to be kind of vulnerable to someone else. But it was this super conscious thing that I remember having a conversation with myself that'll be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that I won't end up worse off or more hurt. Like I wouldn't allow that to happen to myself at this age. And I was 29 at the time. But that there's absolutely this tug of war almost with where your safety net kind of tugs you back into a safer space.
Mm-hmm.
So that in and of itself was almost a sense of bravery or courage to be like, I'm going to do this. And the same was true when we even started couples counseling, and we met together the first time and then one-on-one the second time. And I remember thinking, okay, he's only going to get me alone once, so I'm just going to tell him everything. And shared probably more in that hour than I might have 10 years ago when I was really guarding things as though they were my responsibility to guard. So that just helped really frame things really well. And I think discovering your own sense of power in those stories also helps push back on, will this be used against me? Like all these things that you fear, right? Are they going to judge me? Does this show how weak I am? All of these like things that make you afraid of sharing.
Yeah. I'm so curious in terms of your professional life, how that's shown up for you, because I know that for a lot of women of color specifically, that sense of their childhoods or their experiences or things that they feel are too vulnerable, right, or considered a weakness, can be used in some way against them. How has that shown up for you just in, you know, your professional life?
I think initially I wouldn't share it. I think it led me to where I'm at in context, in kind of subject matter. I enjoy working in things that get me in touch with community, with my neighborhoods, which with areas where I grew up, with people from different cultures, all of those things, I think, are what where I find a lot of that joy and satisfaction and where my life has led. But it really wasn't until recently, maybe in the last 6 years or so, where I've started injecting a bit more of my personal experience or my personal life and why I'm in that room at that moment.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I finally got comfortable talking about was not having a house, not having a home.
Yeah.
14, all of a sudden we had to move, and kids never really are, you're not part of that conversation when you lose your house or, your landlord kicks you out or whatever that situation was. And we had been there for almost all of my life, probably about 12 years, but the husband had started getting really severe dementia and started leading to a lot of bitterness and battles. And so all of a sudden in the middle of the night we're having to move, and we go to family member's house, and again, middle of the night, somewhere down the road, there's a fight. We've got to move again. Yeah. Middle of the night, we're going to a friend's house, another single mom. That was, I think, what I kind of drew out of all of that experience as miraculous and kind of amazing, was this bonding together of single moms.
Yeah.
That I really draw on. But then ultimately we got public housing and we moved to Littleton, and that's where my mom ended up for a long time. Mm-hmm. But all of those experiences, I think, I shelved away. I was going to some of the most elite schools, and yeah, here I am homeless, and yeah, you know, the bus is picking me up at a different house every couple months. And you don't share that.
Mm-mm.
Certainly when you're that age. Even in college, it's not something that you use as a source of power or inspiration. So it really has only been in the last kind of phase of my life where I got really comfortable sharing, because I think, you know, in my prior work, in my current work for sure, there's a sense of distance and difference,
yeah,
from people who are directors of this or elected to that, or, you know, whatever that looks like. And so much of what I focus on in my job was fed directly by that experience.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And for you, I imagine that, you know, so much of our childhood experiences are so normal, right? And there's no context for like differentiating between what is supposed to happen and what's not supposed to happen, until we find ourselves in a context where maybe something's different or we start to question or understand difference. When was it for you that you really started to understand your mom's alcoholism, like that was actually an issue for her?
I think it was, okay, I mean, there are things that I don't remember about my childhood where I'm like, did that happen? Are you sure that happened? I was there, because I don't remember any of that happening. And there are other things where I remember everything.
Yeah.
And those are the moments when she came home too drunk, when her shirt was on backwards because, yeah, she threw up on the other side, when she forgot to pick me up at the bus station when I came back from seeing my aunt in Phoenix, when she forgot my birthday,
yeah,
because she was on, you know, a binge. There are those where it's so remarkable to me how it just took over, because she was somebody who invested so much in her daughters.
Yeah.
And now as an adult, where I also recognize it's been such a lifelong battle for her,
yeah,
how much of a disease it has been in her life. And I think I didn't understand that before, and kind of ate my own bitterness,
yeah,
with those experiences at the time, and then compartmentalized it and moved on. Now as an adult, it's so much more than that. And even when I talk to my sister, who is trying to rationalize it,
yeah,
and try to figure out, you know, but why does she do this? And really to kind of strip away reasoning behind it, mm-hmm. and just recognize that it's physical. It is a physical illness, and it's transformational.
Like, yeah.
And I can't rationalize it as right. though it's an element of her, of how much she cares about her family. You know,
yeah.
that's not it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that it's something that, you know, a disease is not something that you can necessarily, right, without help, treatment, control. And, you know, I think it's hard for people to understand that when it comes to alcoholism or other forms of addiction
yeah.
or dependence. Yeah.
And I know that my family processes weakness badly.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it felt like for her. And she mm-hmm. was... a middle of five kids, and I think always felt kind of like the black sheep of the family. And so to divulge something like that in needing help and it being used against her, that only needed to happen once and then right. it was over, right? So it definitely materializes differently as an adult mm-hmm. when you start to recognize kind of some of the source stuff around it.
Yeah. And it seems like in your process, you've really been able to come to a place of understanding her. And has that ever materialized in you having conversations about your experience as a child or how that impacted you with her?
I don't think I ever have, to be honest. Where I do break through with her, and it's usually because I've let her know that the facade, like, it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
And that piece has created some really helpful moments of vulnerability and honesty. And I also recognize that this, while addiction and alcoholism is something, I think it doesn't matter what your income is.
Yeah.
The options for recovery do. And we were never afforded an option of rehab or therapy or some basis to understand how something like this could be overcome. And you just willed your way through it, and mm-hmm. you just dealt with it, and it was human, and it's just life.
Mm-hmm.
We just never had, I think, those kinds of options. And I think about that often, of how my life is so different from my mom's.
Yeah.
And I talk about that with colleagues who grew up in similar circumstances, that the greatest gift she gave me was that I have a life now of options.
Yeah.
And I can choose things rather than just make the best of
yeah.
what's right in front of me. And that's amazing.
Yeah. 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 I think you're absolutely right. This idea of like how addiction and options related to recovery and treatment are so limited, right? And there's no access. And, you know, a person's financial capacity is so linked to their ability to actually get help. Which, you know, I think it just, again, perpetuates the generational cycle of these things happening, you know, in our families, in our community. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic family, not my parents, but, you know, my aunts, uncles, my very large and extended family, lots of alcoholism. And, you know, one of the things that I reflect on and that I think I've talked to some of my cousins about is this idea of alcoholism as, you know, how we see the adults in our lives acting, right? Which is one part of it. Then the other part of it is the neglect that can come from that, right? And the lack of protection. And how I think when you're so focused on whatever is happening within the adult world, the kids are kind of left on their own. And, you know, that seems true in terms of just responsibility and having to be really the reliable one. But were there other ways that you had that experience where you didn't feel protected or safe, or, you know, it manifested in different ways for you?
Yeah, you know, there, there was a, I think, incidents with a man that my mom was dating, relationship there where he began making advances on me as a young teen and not really understanding what was going on or how to deal with it. And so it took not long for me to then tell my mom what was going on.
Yeah.
I really feel like maybe there were two circumstances of vulnerability where I thought I'm doing something wrong. Yeah. Like this shouldn't be happening. And telling her, and this is where, like I could never say she was never on my side yeah. or ever abandoned me because she believed me. She, and I've seen, women whose parents didn't believe them, mm-hmm. And how much effect that has on their lives. But she did immediately and there was no question and everything just changed immediately mm-hmm. after that.
Mm-hmm.
And she tried, I think, to, reverse course in some way,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really noble and some of this advanced kind of concept of, there are no men in Jamie's life and the ones that were bad to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to go find some good men to influence. So all in school, Grayland, Kent, she would always request a male teacher advisor and thought, okay, this is like, there's going to be somebody who sets a good example in her life. And I just thought that was, you know, simple and yet so, so noble
yeah.
of her to be conscious of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, which I thought was really amazing. The effect I think on me professionally, and this, I didn't recognize until I had to be in my 20s, was that what I thought I had done wrong was be visible.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went on a path of trying to be invisible.
Yeah.
And that created who I was in high school, in college,
yeah.
early 20s, and it created my physical body.
Yeah.
The way that I interacted with men. I mean, it was amazing how insidious it became
yeah.
and really took over how at a physical level I interacted with the world.
Yeah.
And trying to be invisible, was just looking back on my life, such a mistake.
Yeah.
It really affects me to this day that I spent so much time trying to be invisible.
Yeah.
And I think playing on what I assumed to be other people's perceptions of women or of fat women,
mm-hmm.
Or curvy women, and the way that society treats them.
Yeah.
And the mark that they put on beauty as kind of a primary factor. And I thought I was trying to eliminate that from my life too,
yeah.
right? It's just this
yeah.
weird equation in my head of if I eliminate this, then I get this.
Right.
And it was much later in my 20s where I recognized I have goals in my life
mm-hmm.
and I have professional interests in my life, and those are going to require me to be present in a room
yeah.
and to be visible in a room and to command some kind of authority or attention in a room if I really want to advance this goal forward, and working on that,
yeah,
chipping away at it, and then surrounding myself with people who mirrored that.
Yeah.
That was probably the more pivotal thing.
Mm-hmm. How did that happen for you? Was that intentional for you, or do you feel like that was just part of your journey?
Some of it's very intentional. I've always gravitated to very, very present women, mm-hmm. women who are very opinionated, mm-hmm. Have a very strong sense of self. Mm-hmm. And I've just find that at a friendship level, at a relationship level,
yeah.
just incredibly inspiring and yeah. attractive. And I think in the beginning, because I admired it, it wasn't something I had myself. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately it was something that we could reciprocate.
Yeah.
And then finding those women who were that and liked to share that.
Yeah.
Because I've come across other groups of people who are that and only want to be that one in the room. And yeah. so it's, you know, it's you're weeding through to find, the people that, that you're comfortable with, that inspire you. So college was a lot of that exploration. Going to Mexico for 4 months was a lot of that exploration. Mm-hmm. Coming back, changing a major to anthropology, finding that I could be both an observer and kind of a powerful voice in a variety of different contexts kind of set me on this path of reaching.
Yeah.
So that's definitely what that helped me do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that I would say that you identify as an introvert.
Yes.
Would you?
Unless I'm with my book club.
I'm also an introvert. I'm an introvert extrovert, but mainly introvert.
Yeah.
So, and I imagine, you know, I know that for myself to be public or to be exposed in some way, you know, I think is probably related to my childhood, but also related to my bent toward introversion, where I feel really comfortable doing this, feel very uncomfortable doing it in a larger setting. How has that been for you to be in such a public position where it's not just, you know, an audience of a few, right? It's your district, it's the city, it's, you know, very, very public. How have you worked through that?
I've, as an introvert in that space and as somebody who puts a lot of emphasis on authenticity, it actually requires a lot more energy to find that level of authenticity for those spaces. So I don't do small talk well.
Yeah.
I prefer to find something about you that you want to share. That's the anthropology side. Tell me about where you grew up. you know, what do you enjoy about, you know, where we're at, whatever that might look like. Anthropology helped me kind of explore a little bit of that so that I could be comfortable initiating some conversation with somebody and it could still feel real.
Mm-hmm.
I think the campaign really helped me figure out how do I talk to a complete stranger about me in a way that feels real and authentic, and that I could feel really comfortable having had that conversation for 1 minute or 2 minutes and can walk away. And so it was kind of this path of getting very comfortable with the very vulnerable experiences of my past.
Yeah.
Being able to talk with pride about the things that I've done.
Yeah.
And not be boastful and vain.
Mm.
Find ultimately, which is the ultimate gold in that conversation, is the thing that they're also excited about. Oh my gosh. And then you can really get into that.
Yeah.
And I've found that even when it comes to talking about my hobbies or the book we've read or, you know, something that we shared in common, an event that we were both at, you know, it's just finding that little nugget gets me excited about that conversation with the stranger. And the campaign got me to a place where, one, I could have that conversation about a variety of different things, but then I could also have one about who I am and leave that at their doorstep.
Yeah. And what has been for you the most difficult part of being in this position in this very challenging time of COVID?
It is challenging.
You know, all the things that are transitioning, you know, in our city, in so many cities across the country. What has been the biggest obstacle for you?
I think initially this is a year and 4 months, so 16 months in office. It feels like two lifetimes.
How many months? How many more months do you have to go?
32 more months. it's a joke, and yet it's real. but it's part of it has been what has always been my challenge is wanting to feel like I can speak intelligently about subjects that are new to me and things that I'm still learning about, or just being able to have and feel comfortable with my opinion. That's definitely a space that I've grown into. And I think in the very beginning, you know, every Monday we've got to vote on something. And at the end of that discussion, at the end of that question period and comment period, I've got to say yes or no on something. And recognizing when do I feel most comfortable saying yes or no, and when am I really uncertain, that there's a discrepancy between those two states is what I think has been a challenge for me, just getting to a place where I feel ready. And I think as women we face that, and we internalize consequence of each act and each motion. That's been I think most interesting. I think also being able to lead a team dedicated to my vision has been really interesting too. And that's just been just this fascinating journey. Even my career before this, it wasn't so much my dream. It was about immigrants and refugees in Denver, an experience I didn't experience personally. And I don't have the family history that lends itself to that. So the relationship that I have to that is about exclusion and about elimination of something that's so much a part of your identity that it has this generational impact for your family. And I think when we exclude immigrants from the table, from decision-making, from the conversation, it isn't just them that's affected, it's their family, because they internalize that experience of exclusion and they take it home with them. My grandma did. Not being able to speak Spanish in school, she internalized that and took it home and didn't speak it with her kids and made sure there was a distinction in her mind between immigrants and herself as a Denver-born, Mexican-American, New Mexican roots, like all of that. There's still, you're different. And I'm not you. That she still has to this day. So it's, it has this, such a life of its own. And that I think, was what kind of drew me into all of these spaces. What could I lend to this in terms of conversation and experience, and how do I elevate that? And still being able to make the minutiae decisions throughout the day that, you know, might keep a city running or lend itself to this huge responsibility we place on our shoulders to change a system. Like, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't to try to change something. And trying to do that is the ultimate burden.
And how has it been for you dealing with very public criticism of either decisions that you make or perception about what you're doing or what you're not doing? Has that been a challenge for you in this position?
It's been a challenge, but I don't think it's one that I knew that was going to happen, and I knew I would have to do that. And that was the challenge to my introvert kind of nature, right? That I'm publicly responsible for something, or somebody's going to critique me. The emails that I get now that are very critical of a decision that I made, or something that I did on air, or whatever it might be, this is where compartmentalization might come in handy. I'm like, it's just your opinion. The work that I've put into making that decision or launching that idea didn't just bubble up now.
Yeah.
It's been crafted over many years of my life and many years of my mom's life and many years of my grandma's life. And I don't think we abandon that history. I think we're actively living it right now.
Mm-hmm.
And as women in this space, we're driven by that at all kinds of different levels.
Yeah.
It's both what I think I've had to spend a lot of time understanding, in order to find the strength kind of moments of it to put forward.
Yeah.
Cause it could be really hard. I have plenty of family who focus a lot of their energy on the negativity.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there's the negative in their life, mine as well. And yet they've not gotten to a point where they see the value in what it's done for them.
Yeah.
How it's helped them grow. And that's tough to see.
Yeah. 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 I think, this is a perfect segue to the next question, Jamie. Good job. So, you know, this podcast is about Black, Indigenous, and women of color who've overcome trauma and are becoming resilient. What does resilience mean to you?
I think that's what it's meant in my life is that I've been able to turn around and look at the things that I hid from and the things that I tried to hide, because they felt like damage and deficit, that I'm able to turn around and look at them and see them as something that gave me strength over time, which is not easy to do. It's not easy to do when it still hurts you sometimes, you know. It's been interesting, I think, in trying to convey why I never had a relationship with my dad.
Yeah.
Why women tend to be the strongest kind of elements in my life. Why I sought out couples counseling for myself and my husband. It is in trying to better understand what that trauma did to me. Not so much that it happened.
Yeah.
But what it exposed in my life for me and how I evolve around that. The experience of, you know, being approached or being, you know, sexually assaulted. I feel like it wasn't violent, but it was insidious.
Yes.
It was this dark cloud just constantly over my head about myself. About it was never about them and who they were and what was wrong with them. It was always about what did I do to bring that on. And so understanding that, and recognizing that my gut reaction to hide myself from the world, as though that was going to be everybody's reaction as I grew up, was a big part of how I found a voice later on in my life to advocate for myself in a room when I felt differently than colleagues or the boss or whoever, and really feeling like why that was coming up for me, why that reaction was coming up for me. There's validity to that.
Yeah.
It's like you trusting yourself for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really a powerful thing. And so feeling that power propelled more of that.
Yeah.
And not being afraid that if I uncover that ugly rock, it doesn't expose ugliness of me,
yeah,
but of how I built on it and,
yeah,
created something different.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's so good.
Still happening though.
Yeah.
You know,
it's always a work in progress.
It's a work in progress. I remember approaching my husband about counseling after Michelle Obama. We went to see her at Pepsi Center, and she talked about how, really just matter-of-factly, that she and Barack saw a couples therapist.
Yeah.
And I remember looking around at everybody like, does everybody know that? like nobody like gasped, like it's so taboo, right? And I remember when I suggested it to my husband, he had the reaction that I expected other people to have of, this means failure.
Yeah.
This means the end. And we had to work our way through that. But man, it's been, we just have a totally different relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think it's so hard for us sometimes to see it as we don't see therapy as preventative.
Mm-hmm.
We usually see it as an intervention, or we've reached the crisis point, or it's really the thing that can sustain relationships, can sustain us as individuals, you know.
And I think we both thank each other for being willing to be vulnerable and talk openly and be angry and sad and all of those things that as somebody who retreats and he advances, you know, we go crossways sometimes,
yeah,
whether it's be with the dishes or the socks on the floor, you know, the smallest,
yeah,
thing, and just really being able to work through the really root things.
Yeah. 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 Why those things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so, you know, I think the valuable part of therapy is learning things that we might not have learned in our childhood. It's like, you know, we get the opportunity as adults to fill in some of those gaps for ourselves, which is not, you know, to your point, it's about building on whatever it is that we gained, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even the things that we felt were deficits, we're able to look at those and from a different perspective and find a way to continue to work on that, which is so important.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. So I realized one thing you didn't mention.
What's that?
That you, don't you have like a honorary doctorate?
Are you a How did that not come up?
Because no. You never say it. I feel like if you get an honorary doctorate, you should talk about it all the time.
That's hilarious. I do. I do from my undergrad school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have an honorary doctorate, are you allowed to say you're a doctor?
No, I don't think you can.
But you can say, I'm an honorary doctor.
It comes with a little bow on it. It meant so much, both I think to my anthropology advisor who had nominated me and to my mom.
Yeah.
And her just kind of doting. That was tremendous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna keep talking about it. Even if you don't want to.
I'll put a sticker on my business card.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to put it in the show notes. I'm going to find out the official way to talk about someone's honorary doctorate.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Jamie, for being a guest on this podcast.
Thank you. And thank you for doing this podcast. I don't think we hear these kinds of stories often enough.
Yeah, I feel really honored to hold space for it. So, and you know how much I love you.
Right back at you.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Down for my soul, y'all. Yeah, for your soul, yo. This ain't a theory, really. This ain't something that I made up. I like to believe it's not fucking selfish. Like. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you or your company are looking to jump into the podcast world, now is the time.
The Plug Agency is here to connect you to the full power of podcasting. You just record and leave the rest to us. The people are listening and want to hear from you. Theplug-agency.com. That's theplug-agency.com. Click the link in the episode description for an exclusive offer.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.